Who don't know me, I'm Elka Abrahamson. I'm a proud graduate of Hebrew Union College and president of the Wexner Foundation, a place I never imagined I'd be, and a place that I'm thrilled to find myself in. I was a pulpit rabbi for 15 years. That was chapter one of my career, and I've been with Wexner for the second chapter of my career, going into my 15th year. And that's where you go, no, you couldn't have been a rabbi for 30 years. Thank you very much. Let's save some for the third slide, though, okay? And my topic today is collaboration. And Aaron Pankin, my colleague and friend and a Wexner alum, invited me to do this symposium this morning. And it was a thrill for me to do it on collaboration because it's a topic that I have discovered just tremendous literature about, and it's something that's so much harder than we think it is, and most of us think we're doing it, and we're not. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn to my comments, and I'm supposed to speak for 20 minutes, and I have podium timer on, so I'm going to try to stick to my 20 minutes so that we can have a good 20 minutes for give and take, and I don't have the time for you all to introduce yourselves to each other. I wish we did, but just look around the room and make eye contact like you're all friends. Yeah, a little wave, right? Good, good, good. Okay, thank you. So we're going to begin. The name of the session is Collaboration, Are We Built For It? And I think my conclusions will be obvious to you by the end of this session, and I'll let you come to your own conclusions. Are we built on sand or are we built on concrete is the first question I want to ask you. And I want to start with a story that I first read in a book that Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote. He talks about two kids on a beach, and he watches them for a while, and they build this really intricate sandcastle. It has towers and moats, and it's quite beautiful and quite elaborate. And as soon as they finish it and they stand up to admire it, a huge wave comes by and washes the sandcastle off the beach. And Lynn's reaction was the reaction that Rabbi Kushner had, which was, oh, that's devastating. And instead, the kids got excited because they got to build the sandcastle again. And they jumped up and down, and they found a new spot on the beach and began digging with the same enthusiasm. Guess what? The front rows are open, people. Rabbi Saperstein, you come in late. You sit right next to me. Within spitting distance, baby, right there. So he was taken by these two children, and what he realized is that institutions are going to come and go, but the relationships between those kids was enduring. And they may not remember the sandcastle on the beach, but that they would always remember each other and the joy they took in building together. So I'm asking the question, what about Jewish life is built on sand, and what is built on concrete? I will say for sure that Judaism is built on concrete. Let's just start there. Are our institutions, the buildings themselves, built on sand or on concrete? So I want to make the case for change. I teach leadership pretty much every day of my life, and one of the questions that people always ask me is to define leadership. I'm going to give you two definitions in the course of this 20 minutes, but the first is that leadership is inevitably about change. If this was a service, I'd have you read that responsively. I'd say leadership is about change, and you'd respond, leadership is about change. You have been to services as well, so that's good. So I just want to go back to the Pew study. I know that some of us hear the words Pew study and we want to just throw up our arms and say, please don't. And I think that's a huge mistake. I was on the Pew study advisory committee, so if you've lived with these numbers for 9 months, I've lived them. See what happens when you say Pew study? I've lived with them for about 2 years and have really, really studied them. And I'm going to admit that there's a lot of good news, and there's news that makes me anxious. I'm not going to say bad news, but it makes me anxious. And there's no way for me, and I am, those of you who know me, how many of you know me? Okay, good. Wow. You don't know me. No. You think you know me. I think the people who know me would say I'm an optimist. I really am an optimist. And yet, part of this glass is half empty. So I want to just, there's no one here to adjust this. So I'm sorry. I want to just look quickly at these numbers again. Good news, 94% of Jews surveyed are proud to be Jewish. Not sure what that means, but it's good news. 35% of U.S. Jews, as Rabbi Jacobs will, I'm sure, proudly underscore, identify with our movement. A third of all Jews in this country say they're Reform. Without really knowing what that means, that is remarkable. That is opportunity. If I could flash words behind my PowerPoint, it would say opportunity, opportunity. All right, so let's keep that in mind. Interesting news. 22% of U.S. Jews are what we're now calling JNRs. They have their own name, right? Jews of no religion. These are not Jews of another generation who were like Bundists or Yiddishists. These are Jews of no religion. It's not like Jews in Israel. They are Jews who say they are Jews but have no religion. And last Shabbat, I heard about a wedding that took place last Shabbat of one of my children's two day school friends. Jew married to Jew got married on a Saturday afternoon with no rabbi. They're Jews. It doesn't matter to them that they're marrying on a Saturday. It doesn't matter to them if they have a rabbi. They're two Jews who got married because the religious aspect of their life is just not important. And I'm not sure what to do with that. I'm not sure how to integrate that into my Judaism, but we have to keep that in mind. 82%, that's wrong, I'm sorry. So that makes me nervous that I have the wrong PowerPoint, but Jews raised in Reform married non-Jews. The truth is that 58% of Jews are marrying non-Jews. If you break that down into liberal movements, it's 72%. A new crosstab that I can't verify says that 82% of Reform Jews are marrying non-Jews. That is not a good news, bad news statistic. That is just reality. We are mixing more. We are marrying non-Jews. And on every single identity marker, the behavior of those couples change. Again, I'm not giving it a good or bad weight. They're changing, and I'm not sure we have changed enough to meet the needs of that population. And if you go down every marker, it's just different news. And this slide is wrong, so I'm sorry. I changed it. 9% of intermarried Jews attend synagogue once a month. And the truth is, less than one-third of American Jews across the board say they belong to a synagogue at all. Less than one-third. But when I ask any group of Jews, what's their primary, how do we measure, you know, Judaism, we would say belonging to a synagogue. So right there, we have to really rethink how we behave. So collaboration itself has to have serious goals or it's not worth it. What does that mean? The goal of collaboration is not collaboration. That is not sufficient. We have to look for greater results as a result of doing our work together. Really important, and this is from the business world, this is not from the Jewish world, about when businesses collaborate. We have to create an environment where innovation will thrive more than it does in a single siloed institution. I would say we have to make Judaism more attractive, and attractive in ways we have not yet thought of on our own. We have to create a more accessible Jewish community. If that's all you learn from this, I haven't done my job, but that's important. The value of collaborating has to be greater than the cost that will necessarily be incurred when you collaborate. And believe me, there will be costs. Why? What's so hard about it? Let's talk about what's so hard about it. And here I'm really speaking truth, and I don't want anyone to throw things at me. All right, I was a congregational rabbi. I am married to a congregational rabbi. 50% of my livelihood comes from my husband's congregation. I love congregations, okay? So let's just put that in the parking lot for a second, all right? We live in a North American ecosystem of congregations that reflects the society from which they emerge. We built a membership model that requires dues. It's sometimes fairly expensive dues, and it's difficult to sustain by itself. I sit at board meetings. I sat at board meetings. I travel all over the country in my role as a Wexner president. I speak with congregational leaders. Very few congregational presidents say to me, boy, our financial model is like crazy successful, and we have no worries. They exist. It's not the most common thing I hear when speaking with congregational presidents. By necessity, though, we've set up a map that looks like this. We have a movement that's not represented here, but in real time, the map looks like this. And I know on Friday nights when there's a new person in town, especially in towns in the Midwest where the population is growing, but it's growing slowly, in towns like this. I live in Columbus. I was a rabbi in St. Paul. Even when I was a rabbi in San Mateo, California, someone would come through the door and there is a love bomb around that person to get them to join the congregation. Now, part of that is we want people to affiliate, but let's be honest, you know, the tape's running. Part of that is just, you know those cartoons where you see little money bags walking around with dollar signs, with feet? Part of it is just we see a little money bag with feet walking in. Because, and I don't mean that in a crass way, I mean in an honest way. It represents a dues rise if we get new members. And we need those people to support the budgets that we're building. That's how we're built. It's not a, again, I'm not putting a value judgment on it, except that I don't know that it's going to work into the future, especially when one-third of Jews only are walking through those doors. You have two-thirds outside the doors. So what do we do with this? When we hear people talking, and I go to synagogues, and I'm sure Rabbi Jacobs can talk about this, Rabbi Ellenson can talk about this, people love their rabbis. Thank God. They love their synagogues. They love their programs. They love their buildings. They love that individual unit, and that's a good thing. But I don't think it's enough. So if I can put this in one word, we have individual siloed membership models that I think promotes barriers to collaboration. It promotes it. And I'm going to look at those barriers, five barriers to collaboration that in many ways we are perpetuating through this system. So the first barrier is, the first two barriers are about how we think, right? Their attitudes, their motivations, they're sort of how our mind works in this way. So the first one is hoarding. That's both in business and I would say in the congregational model. And I have been around collaboration tables, lots of them. Or attempts at collaborating, and I hear this all the time. We're doing it right. We've got the best rabbi programs. We're already attracting 20s and 30s. If you want to come and see how we do it, you're more than welcome. We'll give you the documents so you can go and do it at your place. I'm not making this up. I'd see a lot of heads going, yeah, you've all heard this, right? Because we hoard our greatness. Why do we hoard it? Because of the last slide, right? Now, hoarding is part of like just human nature. We created it. We invented it. It's mine. Businesses do this all the time. When I first came to the foundation, we were merging two foundations into one. Just me was so complicated because Foundation A and B did things differently. Even how we answered the phones was a three-hour conversation over, you know, well, we have a machine, we have a person, you can't have a person, you can't have a machine, it's too expensive to have the person. It's like, we're talking about the phone, the hold music. I wish I was making this up. It's mine, it's how we do it. So hoarding is a huge barrier to collaboration. Again, I remind you, the hoarding comes from an ecosystem that was largely built in a different Jewish era. Largely built in a different Jewish era. Just to bring that home, when you go back to those Jews of no religion, in my parents' generation, my parents, thank God, are both alive and well. My mother, who turned old last week, she turned 85. She is the president of Hadassah in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, that's sweet, and there's something wrong with it, all right? She's still the president of Hadassah. In her generation, and she's good, 32% of those, right, we're looking at those Jews of no religion, that one quarter of Jews, 7% in her generation say they're Jews of no religion. 7%. My generation, her children, 32% of us, right? I'm sorry, 17% of us. You get to my children, it's 32%. Look at how quickly that's changing. So what will my grandchildren? Thank you. Thank you for the God willings. What will theirs be? So we have to change this model. So that's motivation one, is hoarding. And that's a tough one. That's a tough one. Let's go to motivation two, barrier number two, which is also a mindset. I call it holy arrogance, right? How could things be any better? We are so good at what we do, right? We're so good at it. How could we be any better? So you have to go back to the values proposition. Is there something that we can do better by virtue of doing it together? And holy arrogance, and I love my colleagues. I love them very much. But some of them, a few of them, I've been there. We have holy arrogance. I'm kind of a big deal, right? I went to school for 5 years. This is my congregation. I love it. I love it. And I love them. But, and in my own community, I have to just bang on their doors and just hear me out. Hear me out. And I just can't leave the room, but it's being taped. But I've been working really hard in my community to get us to do one Purim carnival. One Purim carnival. Why do we rent 6 cotton candy machines? We'll make the cotton candy kosher. The Orthodox shuls can join us. Why do we have to rent 47 bouncy toys? The only person who stands to lose is the rental place in one Purim carnival, right? Neutral location. Tell the whole world. Invite the whole world. Because our Purim carnival is the best Purim carnival. So we can't even get past the Purim carnival conversation. So need I say more? So what's this all about? So this slide may be confusing to you. Inevitably, this is my second definition of leadership. Leadership is about delivering loss at a rate a community can absorb. About delivering loss at a rate a community can absorb. Loss of any kind, of anything, is complicated, and it's hard. So my teachers, Marty Linsky and Ron Heifetz of Cambridge Leadership Associates and Harvard, talk about that we're all different kinds of vegetables. I'm a zucchini. My colleague is a mushroom. You can pick your own vegetable. It's not a game, but you could pick your own vegetable. And I like my zucchini-ness, right? I like my mushroom-ness, and I want to retain that. So when you invite me to collaborate, then we're creating what we'll call a stew, right? The problem when you're in a stew is a good stew, if there's any chefs here, you know that you have to cook it just right so that the zucchini-ness is still in there. You can still taste it. But it's not so mushy that it has no identity. So how do you retain your own identity, your own sense of who you are as a zucchini or a mushroom or a red onion, that's what I would be, and yet have a flavorful stew, right? Because both are good. And we're all afraid of getting lost in the stew, right? If we collaborate, what happens to me and my stuff? So just keep that in mind as we go on to the second set of barriers in collaboration, and these relate more to ability and skill, not to what's in your head. So let's say you get past the hoarding, you get past the arrogance, and you have a goal that's clear, and you really believe that you can do better by attracting, you can attract more Jews by being in a collaborative situation. You get to the table, and the behavior barrier number one is defensiveness. Right? We all sit down, we're going to have that joint Purim carnival, which is not collaboration, it's partnership or co-sponsorship. But these tables can very quickly dissolve into avoidance techniques, defensiveness, nobody can make a decision, and we just keep coming up with the next idea, and nobody really wants to run it. That's over-collaboration, right? We just keep going on the treadmill. We clearly can't come to anything. Let's meet again next year and see if we change our minds. It is not, let's meet for a while and conclude that we've all done our fair share and go home, and maybe we'll have a, you know, a joint Tisha B'Av, right? A lot of communities have joint Tisha B'Av. That would be under collaboration, right? So the first is you try to over collaborate, end up with nothing. The second is you do under collaboration, and you, Aaron Pankin comes in and darkens the room. Not taking it personally, Aaron. They turn the lights out on me, but I was just getting to the college too. That's so amazing that you came in here. So you know, not agreeing on anything is not a reason to leave the table, but often it is because we're so well defended, and we really come to be good citizens. But at the end of the day, we're a little bit stuck in our hoarding, in our arrogance. Now, I do think that all those joint programs help us dip our toes in the waters of trust and transparency. Trust and transparency, which is so often missing from these tables. Competition is at these tables. So what has to be left at the door? What armors have to be taken off? Politics, right? Arrogance, that's a mindset, but politics and the next behavioral issue, which is huge. This is, can we really imagine? Can we really imagine what our Jewish community would look like different? And I call this the collaboratory, right? This is the long stage of conversation. This is the stage of patience and openness, and you have to have the right people there, and then you have to be playful, and you have to acknowledge and mean it that we share a common fate. We share a common fate. You know, if you go back into most synagogue histories and you look at their building histories, the buildings we're in were not built in the year 6, right? Most synagogues, certainly the ones that I've served in, there's a wall with the pictures of the different buildings. We've moved, right? We've proven that we're built on sand. And I often wish I could interview the people who made those decisions. Now, maybe it was easy because the neighborhood moved, right? All the Jews moved over here, we'll just the building over here. We have a whole new set of realities, right? We don't know where the Jews are. We don't know where the Jews are going to, we don't even know how they're going to behave. And we can't ignore those numbers. So I'm going to give you some imaginings that you don't have to boo or hiss at or cheer at, all right? I'm just putting them out there as possible conversation starters that might happen at this table. So, and remember, when you're collaborating, saying it is not a commitment, right? We fear that if we say this big idea, first of all, someone will turn to us and say, you're the chair, right? You're paying for it, right? And you're the committee. Sometimes you just have to put ideas out there and let them marinate. So imagine Reform congregations in a small geographic area decide to have one membership fee, one collective, different buildings, but if you join one, you join them all. And then those congregations develop specialties. So imagine that if you're close enough, you could have one congregation specializes in K-3, and you have the best K-3 education imaginable anywhere, not just in Jewish life, because you're going to have one unbelievable educator who knows elementary education. And then you have another synagogue specializes in 4-7, and you're going to have amazing, amazing programs. You have a high school that is second to none that, God forbid, brings all those high school kids into one room so they meet more Jews and more connections, and there are no longer temple youth groups, there are regional youth groups with professional level youth group advisors. Imagine if you sold the building of one of those synagogues. You just sell off a building and you raise $7 million that you can then use to generate 5,000 staff people, engagers in your community to go out and go find those Jews. Because I think we have enough buildings, okay? And I would like to put a camera up in every Reform, synagogue. What are you looking at, Dave? What are you smirking about?
I was just looking at
Rabbi. We're just, ooh, take the gloves off, David. We're just playing, right? But none of this is nonsense. I want to put a camera up in all the buildings in my community, all the Jewish buildings, and watch the traffic for a week. How many people come and go in a week? What are we paying to heat those buildings? What are we paying on mortgages? Let's do real estate assessments. And what would be the cost of leveling it? Believe me, if we were the body assigned today, I'm over my 20 minutes. I'm going to try to finish up. If we were the body today that we locked the doors and said, all right, this group is so good and so smart. Actually, we have my people in the room, I have to say. Let's redesign a Jewish community built for 30,000 Jews. Let's just design it from the ground up. How many think it would look just like it looks today? How many are pretty sure it would look different? All right, so this is what keeps us, right, from getting to different. I could keep going with my imaginings, but in the interest of time, I won't. But I will take the college on for a second, my beloved college. Let's assume we're going to keep all four buildings for the sake of peace and calm. Still, is the best model to duplicate the programs in every single building? Or is, just stop smirking at me. You're not helping me. You are totally smirking. How do I get you to cry? If I thank you, will you cry instead? Well, what if we're developing congregations that specialize in certain areas, why not have campuses of the college become real collaboratories for very specific topics of Jewish life? You will go nowhere today. You will go nowhere and not hear everyone talking about how to attract the, who wants to fill in the blank, the 20s and 30s, the millennials. Why not, at least in a temporary fashion, a collaboratory on the LA campus or the Cincinnati campus? All we're going to do is it's going to be a body of space that thinks about 20s and 30s, gets data on that population, studies that population, does focus groups on that population, does academic research on the developmental reality of that population. What does it mean to be a Jewish no religion? And just stick on that problem and then disseminate information, for example, to the movement. I know that a small number of communities are trying to have these conversations, and when they talk to me about them, it's really confidential. Don't tell anyone. You got to be invited. Like, the shades are drawn. Pull up the shades. Like, let the community know. It's not, talking is not doing. If only talking was doing, right? It is not. We would have done so much. Talking is not doing. Let's get to the last of the behavior problems. Once you get these ideas out there, here's an Einstein. It's not that I'm so smart. It's just that I stay with problems longer. We think of barriers to everything, right? Here's why we shouldn't do it. Well, if we sold off one building and, you know, used all those assets and co-located with the congregation 90 seconds away, what's going to happen to our Sefer Torah? What's going to happen to the memorial wall? How are we going to pay two rabbis? And the conversation stopper of all conversation stoppers, what about high holy days? Boy, yeah, that should stop conversations, right? Where are we going to fit 1,200 Jews if not in our building? I hear it over and over again. That cannot be the conversation stopper. We can solve the big problems if we stay with them longer. Now, I don't want to minimize congregational identity and the attachment people have to their synagogues. That's a huge barrier. But I also don't want to minimize the fact that the numbers are telling us that we're not attracting people the way we ought to into the existing structure. Okay? By the way, when business managers, 185 business managers were surveyed recently to see if they were collaborative, 16% score high on collaboration. Right? In the business world, too, it's really high. And those of us who have achieved some measure of success, our congregations, rabbis, We have done so because we're driven to succeed, and we're driven to succeed in a competitive model. So we really are built as collaborative people. I want to read this quick quote by John Gardner, which I love. If you haven't read Gardner, he's great. Great leadership thinker. A pluralistic society invites each organization, institution, or special group to develop and enhance its own potentialities. But the price of that treasured autonomy and self-preoccupation is that each group concern itself also with the common good. That is not idealism, it is self-preservation. If the larger system fails, the subsystems fail. That should not be such a difficult concept for the contending groups to grasp, but it is. If the congregation up the road has to fold, we go, oh, that's too bad. Can we have your roster? Right? That's what we do. How do we lead in this world and not react in this world? The future announces itself from afar, but most people are not listening. The noisy clatter of the present drowns out the tentative sounds of things to come. The sound of the new does not fit old perceptual patterns and goes unnoticed by most people. So I'm trying to sound the bell a little bit that we may need to rethink our patterns. And I want to show you this wonderful video. You may have seen it. I'm not promoting the product. I just love the video. Hope you enjoyed that video. How do I go back here? Oh, I'm sorry. Let me get to the... Want to see a picture of the kids? Just a minute. Okay. There we go. We're done in 5 minutes? I'm sorry, I talked way too much. Too bad. How many of you have seen this? Okay. Pretty clever, right? So what would it be like if we realized that we can't get to the next level unless we had to unlock the future together? What if we couldn't open up our synagogue? What if those locks didn't work unless we shared the keys? So I don't have any great truth here, except I think we have to change the way we think and talk, which is a pretty big challenge. And I'm really sorry. I thought we had a different time schedule. But there's plenty to talk about. So why don't we just take, like, not the answers. We have time for, like, five or six comments if you make them real comments or questions. So just go.
I believe there's another category.
I mean, I don't think this is, you know, for this Jew or that Jew. I think this is for the good of all Jews. By the way, the most recent, I don't know, Rick, if you saw the recent Orthodox Union cover of their magazine was, is American Jewry vanishing? And this is, you know, the Orthodox Union. And J.J. Schachter, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, a great Orthodox thinker, says, we're being too smug. Don't kid yourselves. You know, we're in the same boat. You know, the story of the hole being drilled, we're all in the same boat. Another comment?
I think we need to talk about how technology
I just want to mention, Rick, that I didn't have time to share this text, but you know, when the temple was destroyed, Rabbi Judah, who everyone was mourning and they were bemoaning and moaning and moaning. He finally said, "Like, stop, stop kvetching, and I'm wrapping it up. Stop kvetching and let's build something else, right? So, you know, we can bemoan a lot, but we've got to build something else or something else with." Maybe not replacing, but there is going to be loss when we start changing the way we do business.